It's the other thing I've learned. Always test your microphone. Oops. Sorry. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Julia Minguillon. I am in the Internet Interdisciplinary Institute at the Open University of Catalonia. We will finish today this interesting conference about free knowledge and free technology, with a focus on education and for a free information society. First of all, I have a message from the organizers. You have in your back a feedback form, and we are really interested in you filling it and giving that back to us. So please, if you haven't already done so, please do it. It's really important for us to know what do you think about the conference, the organization, and so on. Well, these 3 days, we have been discussing about freedom with very many different visions. As Ludwig Wittgenstein said, if we spoke a different language, we would perceive a somewhat different world. It's important, therefore, to understand each other's position in order to enlarge and to improve our world. We cannot allow language to be the limits of our world. This is what Wittgenstein intended to mean with his sentence. I would also like to quote two other people that which are really well known by their works about or their lives about or related to freedom. One of them is Nelson Mandela, of course, that said, he said that education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. And I think that probably all of us will agree with that definition. Fighting for education, in fact, and knowledge is fighting for freedom. It's the basic idea behind this message, that everything starts with education and everything starts with knowledge. Directly related to this, Eric Fromm, another great thinker related to the concept of freedom, said that human history begins with man's act of disobedience, which is at the very same time the beginning of his freedom and development of his reason. This idea of fighting or facing against what is established is one of the most important things that we have, I think, that we have been discussing these days. This free knowledge and free technology conference is somehow an act of disobedience against this established system which controls or tries to control the access to education, which should be, or at least I think it should be, free. Our first keynote speaker today is a very well-known fighter in the education arena. Stephen Downs has become a leading voice in the areas of learning objects and metadata, the use of weblogs in education, content syndication, digital rights, and many other related issues to education and the use of information and communication technologies. He maintains a successful web, that you can see it on the screen, www.downs.ca, and I would say an even more successful blog named Half an Hour. And as he says, it's a place to write half an hour every day just for me. I would say that just for me means just for any one of us, because I think that any one of us should take a look to his interesting blog every day. Well, it's my pleasure to welcome Stephen Downs for his presentation today, and please join me in welcoming the first keynote speaker of this session. Stephen?
Well, I am going to hope my computer does not fall off the podium. I think I'm going to run it like this because it's easier for me to see it. This interesting specimen you see on the screen is some kind of plant. I don't know what kind of plant it is. I found it on the Canary Islands. It's about halfway across the island of Gran Canaria, where Highway 21 intersects Highway 230. And it's, I don't know, 500, 800 meters in altitude. And I've been trying for the last week or so to find out what kind of plant it is. And as I was looking around, looking at different plant sites, trying to match the photograph to resources, I encountered this page, And this is the sort of thing that's pretty common when I'm doing research on whatever sort of subject. It's a page that's basically blocking access to, in this case, the picture of the plant that I am attempting to identify. What struck me, because this is not an unusual thing at all, and anyone who does research at all encounters this kind of page many, many times, is that, and I'll read this to you, the resource you are attempting to access is a part of a digital library called Aluka. Okay. Access to Aluka is provided through participation by not-for-profit institutions of higher education, as well as secondary schools, public libraries, museums, and other research or cultural institutions across the globe. This is supposed to be, in other words, a resource that is available for public learning. And yet, here I am, a member of the public, attempting to learn, and I'm being blocked by this access screen. Now, education matters, and it matters, I think, more than just simply to change society. I think it matters in a deep and personal way to each one of us, and we see that manifest in society. In San Mateo, also on Gran Canaria, just touring around, I happened upon what appears to have been a spontaneous protest. I don't know what the details of the protest are, but it's evident that it was a very unofficial and very impassioned defense of public education. Public education generally, is not simply a matter for academics and philosophers. It's not simply something to do with theory. It has to do with the basis of our society and indeed the basis of ourselves, and I'll talk about that more. Now, what's important is not the education part. What's important is the public part of education. And a big part of the purpose of my talk today is to talk about the public part of education. They say always lead with the demo. I've coded an application. It's called Grasshopper. And what Grasshopper is basically the application that I use to run my website. Here is Grasshopper in operation on my website, and as you can see, I create various types of content on the left-hand side, where I access different types of content, and I can list the different posts that are on my website. Here they are. Here's a post on yesterday's talk. On Richard Stallman yesterday's? No, that was 2 days ago. And there's the link to it. And all kinds of other content on my site. But Grasshopper does quite a bit more than that. Grasshopper is also a harvester. I have a way of managing a list of RSS and Atom and other feeds. And here's my list of feeds. I can export this list of feeds as an OPML file if I wish. For any given feed, I can manage the feed. Let's have a look at one of these feeds. So here's the information about the feeds. I can edit the information about the feed, define the type, give it a category, addresses, all of that sort of stuff. Harvest the feed. I just click harvest. It's going to take a couple of seconds. There it is. It is harvested. Now all of this stuff has been imported into my system. And now if I wish, one of the things that I could do, I'll just back up here, go back to my admin screen. I can read the stuff that has been harvested. Here's one of the posts that I just harvested. Now I'm reading it in my reader. I can read more. And if I want, I can now take the content of the post that I just harvested. Now I'm back in my editor, and you'll see that this is an editor for editing posts. These are the posts that appear on my website, and they also appear in my newsletter, because the way I define posts is that I can have posts distributed as HTML, I can have posts that are distributed as email, I can have posts that are distributed as RSS, and indeed I can create any sort of format for a post that I want using a simple template editor. And so you see the concept that I've attempted to create using the software. The idea here is to have an application that aggregates resources, that allows me to remix and repurpose these resources, and then allows me to feed them forward. And it'll remind people who are old enough of the old Userland software. There's a lot of influence of the Userland software in this, I'll freely admit that, although I personally didn't like Userland. I didn't like the way that it was computer-based rather than web-based, which meant that I had to use it on a particular computer. And Userland had nothing like mappings. And what a mapping is a way of taking content from one type of content, say a blog post, say a calendar listing or whatever, and then you can map the elements of the one type into the elements of the other type. So I could take an RSS post and map it into an event. I can take an event post and map it into a presentation, whatever. So I can mix and match how my content connects together. Because the other part of what I'm trying to do with this system is not simply aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward, but also to, on the fly, and in a very efficient way, to draw connections between the different resources. And so one of the things that this harvester does is it does not simply harvest, but when it harvests, it looks at the links that are in the post and keeps track of all the links that are in the post that it harvested. It looks at the author of the post, the source of the post, and it records those separately. So it doesn't simply harvest the post. It deconstructs the post and finds all the different ways that that post is related to other things, other people, events, other posts, whatever. I also organize the content and especially connect the content by topic. A lot of people have talked about tagging. I am way, way too lazy to tag my content, so I have my machine do it for me. And basically for me, what a tag is, here's a tag, academia, for example, and it's the discussion of a topic area, but literally what it is, here's the title, which is what people would normally tag it, and then I define a tag as a regular expression. And then when I harvest a piece of content, I apply the regular expression to the piece of content. If I get a hit on the regular expression, that content is tagged with that tag. And it's really handy to define a tag as a regular expression because it means I can tag things retroactively. Podcasting, for example, is a term that existed in 2004 but did not exist in 2003. But in 2003, I wrote an application called Ed Radio, which was a forerunner to podcasting, directly related to podcasting. But I wrote it before I would ever have tagged anything as podcasting. But when I created my podcasting tag, all I did is I just wrote podcasting and I typed re-index. I typed yes where it says re-index. And what this meant is the regular expression was applied to every post and every link currently in my database and matched against each and every one of these things. It takes a few seconds to do this because there are hundreds of thousands of things to match against. But the result is everything was tagged, or not tagged as the case may be, with podcasting going all the way back to the beginning, which is 1998, of the first records in the system. So even before podcasting was invented, if something was relevant to podcasting, it was tagged podcasting, which I found very useful. But again, the purpose of this is to create ways of linking content. So I've linked this bit and this bit and this bit and this bit of content along with this Wikipedia article, all under the heading of the topic academia, but the point here is these pieces of content are linked together. They are in certain ways relevant to each other. And then, of course, I've created both JavaScript feeds so you can embed them as widgets in your web pages or whatever, and RSS feeds for these topics as well. So you know, because the idea, and this is a key and crucial point, the idea of this software is that it is not software that is run by a group or an organization. You're not running this software to build a community that will gather around your concept or your idea or your software or whatever. You can have people come to your site. There are, you know, ways for people to register, to post comments, and to subscribe to feeds or subscribe to the email newsletters. But the idea here is that this is a personal environment, a personal learning environment, a personal research environment, a personal living environment. And so the idea here is I have not created social software, although it has social elements. I have not created a content management software, although it has content management elements. I've created a way to be a node in a network of connected learners, of connected thinkers. People talk about freedom. We listened to Richard Stallman the other day. And it's the old Hobbesian definition. The Hobbesian definition, Thomas Hobbes defines freedom as the absence of restraint. Freedom is typically described in terms of the ability to do something, to do this, to do that, to have freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of religion, whatever. Yesterday, for example, Serrato was talking about the freedom of artists and activists and talking about transmission, the freedom to distribute their message. And freedom in this way becomes externally defined. It becomes defined in our objects, in their creation, in their production, in their transmission. But my own take on freedom is that freedom is more fundamental than that. Freedom is not defined by what we do. Freedom is defined by what we are. Freedom isn't simply an absence of restraint. Freedom is the capacity to become. For example, and I think this is a classic example, having a legal right to do something is meaningless if you do not feel that you can do it, if there are practical restraints that stop you from doing it. I don't want to criticize Richard Stallman particularly, but I will, because in this instance it's appropriate. Having the capacity to look at the code and modify the code is very distinct from being able to modify the code and look at the code. Having the capacity to go in and change your operating system is very different from being able to do so. I run Linux desktops, and it's a miserable, miserable experience. It's a beautiful experience in many ways, and I enjoy the freedom that I have, but there are many things that I cannot do. Even on my own website, I simply cannot do it because Linux and the associated applications are too complex for me to take the time to sit down and figure it out. My life is too short to spend learning Linux. That's a practical reality. So having the right to view Linux code doesn't give me the freedom to do so. The freedom to do so, the freedom of owning my own software, controlling my own software, must entail a practical sense of owning and controlling my own software. Now, I mentioned the complexity of Linux code. That's just one example, and it's not even an important example. A more fundamental way in which this sort of freedom could be abridged is if I am afraid that there might be legal consequences to using my code. This is the old fear, uncertainty, and doubt response from the commercial media, right? If I am afraid to use Linux code because I think I might get sued by Microsoft or Blackboard or whomever for doing it, that is an abridgment of my freedom. Even if I have the legal right to use that code, even if in fact I would win such a lawsuit, if I'm afraid of engaging that lawsuit, my freedom has been abridged. Freedom is an attitude. It's an attitude that is based on a self-perception of the capacity to become, to do, to be. It's a perspective of self-determination, a perspective of self-governance. It's an attitude toward ourselves. And just as an aside, people say education makes the difference. We heard that in the introduction. The reason why they say education makes the difference is because once people are educated, then they, first of all, recognize that they are not in a state of freedom, and then secondly, know how to get themselves out of the state of freedom. That's the way it's supposed to work, right? It's classic Paulo Freire. But that's only one part of the conditions of restraint, the conditions of non-freedom. The one part is being able to recognize and engage in and take your own freedom. But on the other hand, there are also oppressors, even the paranoid sometimes have enemies. And simply being educated, we see time and time again, is not sufficient to create a condition of freedom when there are other conditions, such as fear, uncertainty, doubt, such as the complexity of the software, such as, and there are many, many more conditions, that create practical constraints against becoming who you want to be. And these constraints vary from society to society. Freedom is and ought to be a condition, and I say this on my website, where each person is able to rise to his or her fullest potential, where they're able to express themselves fully and without reservations. And by express, I don't simply mean talk or preach or print or whatever, but I mean be. And where they are able to form networks of meaningful and really and rewarding relationships. And to me, fundamentally, this translates, at least in part, to a definition of freedom as access. I again, because of the conditions of this conference, I find myself contrasting my view to Stallman's. And just as an aside again, I think it's a privilege to be on the same agenda as Richard Stallman. Going to be able to write about that to my grandchildren. I want her to... Never mind. When I was studying for my education, I was going deeply into debt, getting my education, but I reasoned it to myself this way. They can't take the education away from me, no matter what I do. And of course, strictly speaking, that's not true, right? They could drug me. But in fact, they didn't. And they never did get all their money, so I win. But it's the same sort of thing, right? No matter what happens, you can't take away the fact that I shared an agenda with Richard Stallman. Anyhow, Stallman is defining freedom from the perspective of the person who has, holds, owns, or controls the resource. I am defining freedom from the perspective of the person who, for some reason and in some way, needs the resource. And I think that is, in a certain sense, a more fundamental freedom, and it's certainly a broader freedom than one contemplated, I think, by the concept of free software. And what this becomes to me is, as the slide says, a society where knowledge and learning, and I'll talk about what that means in a bit, are public goods, freely created and shared, not hoarded or withheld in order to extract wealth or influence. And that's a very different definition of free, but I think a more fundamental and more important one, and in particular, a definition of free that is more applicable to educational resources than the definition of free used in free and open source software. Now, the original title of this talk was The Future of Education, so I feel a bit obligated to talk about the future of education. But this view of the future of education will give you a sense as to where I'm coming from, both with the software and with the definition of free that I talked about. And I talked in 1998 in a paper I wrote called The Future of Online Learning about the development of a tool that we eventually came to know as the learning management system. And I said the development of such a tool makes it not just possible, but inevitable that education will become deeply personalized. And it hasn't happened yet, but it's going to happen. But what has been stopping it or stalling it has been, in my mind, the concept of the class. I didn't get a chance to put this into the slide, but maybe I can get to it now. With George Siemens, here it is, with George Siemens in this fall, the two of us are offering online a course on connectivism, and it's going to be an open course, which means anybody can take the course for free, and there's a course blog, I'm just trying to find the link to that. And I don't see the link to that, which, of course, figures it'll be on the course wiki, right? Yes, here we go. Yeah, course blog is available here. Too many links. I last night, well, instead of preparing for this talk, I was writing a post for the connectivism course, and I wanted to draw the distinction between courses and classes because our system of education right now is based on the idea of class, and the idea of class is based on the idea of groups, or sometimes called a cohort of learning. And from my perspective, as I talked about in this particular post, the concept of the class really is an administrative unit rather than a practical learning unit. And really, the concept of the class has very little, if anything, to do with education. Just as an aside, for those of you who are scrambling to get that link, I will put that link on this page in my slides, and I will put these slides on my website that you saw at the beginning of the talk, because I'll use my Grasshopper tool. I have a content element called presentation, and all of my presentations, including slides and the audio recording, are stored in that content element. So when you go to my website later today, you'll find at the very top a link to a page about this presentation with the slides and with the audio, and if they send it to me, eventually with the video as well. There's that video of many of the presentations as well. The idea of the class is based on the idea of the group. It's based on the idea of learning as a social enterprise. It's based on the idea of, as Witkowski and others talk about, the zone of proximal development, a commonness, a sameness in the understanding that occurs between learners. But my own thinking of this contrasts that view of learning with a view of learning as a network phenomenon. And what that means is that the learner, instead of becoming emotionally attached to some sort of group, some sort of idea, philosophy, vision statement, or whatever, rather engages in a process of mutual interaction and communication with other people, including students, including the instructor, including various materials and resources, etc. Aggregate, remix, repurpose, feed forward. That is the process of learning in a network. And I draw out this argument at length elsewhere because the concern is, without the group, we'll end up atomizing. We'll end up as a society of Ayn Rand clone-type individuals out to serve our own private selfish interests. But that is not the opposite of, or the alternative to groups at all. The idea here is that as autonomous, diverse individuals in a network, we are essentially connected to and communicating with other people in the network. And what we are, what we become, and what society becomes is based on and as a result of those communications. It is essential to our being that we are communicating beings, that we are part of this network, that our communications are receiving of content in our act of remixing and repurposing this, and our act of transmitting this is what defines us, quite literally. But Stallman focuses on the feeding forward. I am very interested in the aggregating, remixing, repurposing, and what that makes us. Today, we still have, in the field of learning technology, the idea of the teacher and the class and the existing power structure. And even saw, again, Richard Stallman a couple of days ago, talking about learning, talking about a classroom, and saying students who bring software into a classroom should be required to share their software. The classic power relationship, right? When you walk into a classroom, you are no longer in control. You can be told what to do, and all those freedoms that were so important no longer exist. But learning that is free is very different from learning that is not free, because learning that is free teaches you to be free, and learning that is not free teaches you to be not free. So there is a shift taking place in education. In 1998, I described that as a shift from the class to the topic. And that's why you see topic is such an important element in my own Grasshopper software. Today, we're seeing this in the field of learning technologies in the form of the development of competences. And there's a project that's called 10 Competences based in Holland. It's Rob Koper's newest work. And there's all kinds of competency standardization efforts going on. And the ground for that is, in fact, to move the basis of education from a social setting and to a topic-based setting. And therefore, to change learning from something that is community-based to something that is personal. Now, there are issues. Competences are based on identifiable skills or capacities. So they are correctly tied to growth rather than content. They're tied to the idea of what you become rather than what you're studying. That's good. And competences allow, students to select their own track or achievement path. When you're given an array of competencies that you could learn, that gives you the freedom to select the sort of thing that you want to learn and therefore the sort of skill that you want to grow in yourself. And technologically, the way this is all supposed to work is that for each given competence, there will be a corresponding learning object or content object or learning resource. So you want to take this competence, you take this resource. In practice, not so much so, but nonetheless, that's the idea. And so that gives us a basis for automation and mechanizing our learning system, right? You select the competence, or you have that competence selected for you by your employer or your parents or your educator or whatever. And then down the chute rolls the learning object. You do the learning object all by yourself, and you achieve that competence. That's the theory. Now, of course, the all by yourself part is a bit of an exaggeration. There are ways you can learn with other people, but the way that transpires in learning technologies, you get dragged straight back into that cohort, straight back into that class, and you become choreographed through a mechanism of learning design. I won't go into the issues with learning design. I will focus on competences briefly. It's not clear that an outcomes-driven system is what we want. Competences based on the idea of measurable achievement of capacities or skills, but that's doing, not being. I could, perhaps a little fallaciously, accuse them of classic behaviorism. But there are things, there are types of learning that we want that do not have measurable, demonstrable outcomes, much less measurable, demonstrable economic value to society, like art appreciation, for example. The idea that you would have some way of understanding or perceiving or comprehending cultural works by themselves and in the context in which they are created. It's not clear that all learning is identifiable as a measurable competence at all. Learning is a process of becoming, it's a process of growing, and not everything that we become and we grow is identifiable as a measurable outcome. Testing is, in general, a way of abstracting, a way of trying to find out what you know by trying to find out what particular things you know. But understanding what a person knows is more accurately a process of recognition, where somebody who is already an expert in a discipline is able to make the complex assessment rather than the complicated assessment that a person is indeed knowledgeable in a domain. But where we are headed is something like this. I think the competences movement will founder on these objectives, but the idea of personalized learning will be successful. And where the selection of learning resources will not be some kind of special activity that we undertake or have undertaken for us by our employer, but rather the selection of learning resources will be something that is embedded in the rest of our lives as a whole. Think about the way we learn in the context of a video game. If you play Civilization or Doom or EA Hockey or any of these things, those are the ones I like anyways, and you're trying to play the game and you need to learn how to play the game or need to learn some concept in order to play the game better. The game will teach you these things in the context of the game. You don't stop the game and go off into some learning mode typically. Rather, the learning is delivered as part of the process of playing the game. And the learning is delivered as part of the process of playing the game, importantly, not simply as text, not simply as structured, syntactical, semantically relevant content, but rather as a series of cues. Any game will have, for example, a rich and complex audio layer, and if you look and analyze this audio layer is providing you with a sequence of cues to tell you about what's happening in the game. That audio layer is learning that's happening in the game, for example. So, we get some sort of idea of educational delivery systems where learners select topics. Topics are selected according to a variety of criteria that are based on the learner's interests and preferences, etc. And where these selections may be informed externally, and I put in there relevant legislation and jurisdiction, employer criteria. The idea here is that things that are external to us feed educational content into the system. We are able to aggregate this content from sources such as our employer, such as the government, whatever. And then the process of topic selection can be, as envisioned by the competences people, like selecting a television channel, but is more likely to be something that just happens incidentally as the consequence and in the context of some other activity. The idea, I put it sometimes, that learning and living are not separate activities, that we live and we learn at the same time, that when we're doing whatever, we have the opportunity. We open up a can of strawberry jam. The strawberry jam offers to instruct us on how to make strawberry pie. If we cast a fishing rod into the sea, the fishing rod offers to instruct us on how to cast properly, because the rod knows that what we just did was not a proper cast. And so we have a concept of learning systems as, if you will, topic delivery systems. There's out there in the ether somewhere an application, a website, a resource, or somewhere that delivers information about making strawberry pies, that delivers information about casting fishing rods, that delivers information about trigonometry, whatever it is that you happen to need in any particular context. And the original intent in 1998 through to, well, today for many people, is that such systems would deliver what we call learning objects. Now, in practice, what happened is the concept of the learning object, which was originally a computer concept and was intended to be an object in the sense of object-oriented software, was captured by the publishing industry. The object became instead something more like a book. And so our way of talking about an object and defining an object and describing an object became more like bibliographic metadata, finding a book in a library, as opposed to defining functions and functionality and interaction and inheritance and those sorts of things. So these days I use the term learning resources, and just for the record, because Richard Stallman was saying to me, don't say content, don't say content. Well, that's quite so. Shouldn't say content, shouldn't say learning objects. We both agreed learning resources would do. And I consider that a great achievement, because delivery systems today, the learning management system, are essentially content delivery systems based on the publication model. They're institutionally based and they tend to focus on classes. Think of textbooks for your class. But the concept of the personal learning environment will replace this, is in the process of replacing this. There is a link that I will put on this page. It only came out like 2 days ago. It's in my email, but I didn't want to read my email in front of the entire audience here, so I didn't get a chance to put it in. There's a journal, an open access journal, that has just done an entire issue devoted to the personal learning environment. So I'll toss that link in there. The idea of the personal learning environment will replace learning management systems. It's based on the idea of personal access to resources from multiple sources. It's based on a personal web presence. Richard Stallman said, and I agree with him, that every person should have their own website. I don't know if they should have it sitting on their own machine, sitting in their own living room, which I think might be his vision. My machine is quite happily hosted at a company in Texas. I don't mind that. I don't really feel I'm losing any freedom as long as I got full backup. If I don't have full backup, then I'm worried. But we'll leave that aside. The idea here is that it is based on a personal web presence. And the focus is on creation and communication rather than on content, rather than on doing the chapter or whatever. The focus is on bringing in these materials, to be sure, but as I say, aggregating, remixing, repurposing them, and then fundamentally and importantly passing them on to other people. Grasshopper, which I showed you, is an early prototype personal learning environment. Well, that was different. I didn't do that. No. Oh, well. Let's just continue. For those of you listening on audio, whatever light was on me suddenly stopped being on me, and I was plunged into darkness. How odd is that? How does that happen? Okay. In an important sense, the personal learning environment is a concept and not an application. Now, I just showed you an application. Right? The personal learning environment can be an application. But the idea is that the functionality, the envisioned functionality, is available through many applications. The idea here is that there's no particular place that your learning takes place, but rather your learning can take place in many different places across the web, across the net, and your access to it is personal. So it's the famous Scott Wilson diagram depicts yourself at the center, accessing and working with resources in different places across the web, on Flickr, on 43 things, on Wikipedia, on a personal or on a university system, wherever, on my own blog. The whole point of a system like mine, the thing that I aggregate most of all on my system, on Grasshopper, is my own content that is stored on Flickr or on Blogger or on a wiki or wherever in a discussion list. I aggregate my own content because I go around all over the place. I leave content everywhere. I'm a content, I don't know what you want to call it. What's the opposite of junkie? Dealer. No. Anyhow, everywhere I go, I shed content like hair. And I want that back so that I can rework it and remix it so that my content environment forms some sort of coherent whole, that the thing that I did on Blogger is in some way related to the thing that I did on Wikipedia or on Flickr. I think of learning in this way as though it's almost like a big game, right? It's not doing things personally. It's not working my way through the manual. It's me with my content and other people and their content, and we've got all of these interactions happening together, and we try to do things. We form groups sometimes. We send communications back and forth together. And all of the things that we do, whatever those things may be, become part of the personal profile that aggregates and becomes a description of myself over time, and that in turn informs new challenges. In a game, your personal profile is, you know, like experience level, hit points, whatever. In real life, your personal profile is composed of different things. In contemporary society, it's composed of high school graduation, criminal record, marriage certificate. Your results may vary. And these personal profiles will become more detailed and stored in many different places across the net. And who you are publicly is a combination of all of these elements. one of the things I'm going to build one day or suggest somebody else to build is a very simple thing. And all it does is it matches user IDs, names, open ID addresses, to data points. And that's all it is. And the idea here is that you can match a piece of data to a user. So what's that piece of data? Well, that piece of data could stand for anything. Could stand for the having passed a test, right? Driver's license, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. It could stand for having published in a journal. It could stand for being an Episcopalian, whatever. And the idea is that a personal profile is a combination of all those data points. All those data points are stored wherever they're stored. You know, the License Bureau, the Criminal Records Bureau, the Church of Episcopalia, whatever. I know there's no such thing as that, but never mind. And that's your profile. And that profile is what informs what kind of resources are aggregated when you're out there aggregating resources. So we sort of think of the menuization of learning, and that's sort of the way it exists now outside of learning, right? Outside of learning institutions, we can do whatever we want to learn. If I want to learn about a plant, all I need to do is sit down and start learning about a plant, and I access different resources. And in this case, I put a post on a plant specialist list, and I put a photo on Flickr, and I put a question into Twitter, and I'm trying to learn about this plant. I learn about this plant personally by working this network. I got one response from the Twitter comment via Facebook. Nothing from the mailing list yet, and of course my attempt to do a search was blocked. So we need to stop thinking of education and educational delivery as a system, like a learning management system or a content management system, or like a social software system, like Facebook or whatever. We've got to stop thinking of learning management and learning design as a system and start thinking of it as a network of connected entities. And when we talk about how we're going to build this, we talk not about the technology, we talk about the standards, the manner in which content is communicated back and forth. And so we need to stop thinking of education as something self-contained and big and whole, but rather think of education and learning and the resources related as entities that will be part of and will interact with in a communication sort of way with the larger environment. And a good example of this is the photo editor that connects to, you may have seen this, if you use Flickr at all, there's a photo editor you can access from within Flickr called Picnic. Picnic is a separate application. What happens is you access Flickr, you go to Flickr, and you hit the Picnic link. Flickr sends your photo to Picnic and then sends you there. And so now here you are in this completely different application, different website, different owners, working on your photograph. And then you finish editing your photograph, you send it back to Flickr, and you get sent back to Flickr. Offering an educational service is like offering Picnic. And Picnic isn't the place you log into and go. Picnic is just something that happens in the context of something else. Picnic just shows up when you were looking at your photos in Flickr and decided, that's too blue, or whatever. We talked about art appreciation earlier. Imagine what an art appreciation learning resource would do for Flickr. Why not? You just imagine, right? You take a photo of something, and there's a thing in Flickr that says, your photo looks like a Monet. Want to learn about that? Or whatever. Okay, that's a bit exaggerated, but you know what I mean. And not only that, the resources that you create and you work with, your photograph, say, that you have edited or worked with or etc., becomes a part of a composite whole. I don't know if you've seen the video. It's one of those TED videos, and I'm not really happy about TED video because they charge like $10 million to go sit at TED. So it's something like if you're rich enough, you can go to. And so anyhow, but there's this video of a composite image of St. Peter's created because St. Peter's is something a lot of people have taken a photograph of. And so they created a composite 3D image of St. Peter's out of all of the photos on Flickr that have been taken of and tagged St. Peter's. And so your idea of the whole emerges through the interrelation, and you have to keep in mind, right, the spatial relation of each of these individual photos matters. The way they're related to each other matters. And our image of the whole is created by connecting and organizing each of these separate individual contributions. So our social knowledge, if you will, of St. Peter's is composed of our individually created and edited and managed perspectives of St. Peter's. And this applies for physical objects like a building, but it also applies to concepts and knowledge generally. And as I said in the slide there, that is the fundamental understanding behind connectivism, which will be the topic of that course. So what does this mean? Educational institutions, and in particular public educational institutions, need to make these resources available, make the editors available, maybe make raw materials like photos available, make resources available to students for use in these other contexts, instead of, as they typically do, make the student come to the university or come to the school or whatever. They need to take these resources and get them out into the community, into the digital community, the digital world where people are. And such resources ought to be offered to people automatically, freely, without restraint, without cost. It doesn't work if you put barriers in front of it. And so you can think of resources as being offered as though from a library, but that will be the exception rather than the rule, but more likely event-driven through some sort of system event, time-driven. Tony Hurst at the Open University has created an NFT RSS-based system that feeds you educational materials over time, or instructor or mentor or coach-driven. As I do, for example, in my own newsletter, I offer educational events to people. Generally, they're web pages, but they're not always web pages. These resources, and we come back to the original conception of learning objects, ought to be able to learn about the environment, learn about the student, and get this information from across the internet. Picnic knows not just about your photo, it knows about you. And Picnic should, with appropriate permissions, be able to learn about your own preferences in photo editing when you're editing that photo. And then communicate that state and other information, again, as authorized to other systems. Not a simple prospect. And we are nowhere close to there yet. But we are beginning to see signs that educational institutions, particularly forward-looking ones, like the Open University, they're a good example, like the BBC is another good example, of putting content out there, making content available for use, for application in other domains. We need this because personalization is more efficient, but more importantly because personalization offers people a measure of control over their learning. It offers a way for people to shape their own learning. What it isn't is competences. What it isn't is machine-driven. First the machine evaluates you, then it serves you up material, then it evaluates you, then it grades you, then it finds you deficient. It's not that. This is a system that is run by humans, It is a system where humans work with and exchange resources with each other. Now let me just tie up the loose ends and point to where free learning fits into this. The picture of learning that I've just described is, as you should see by now, is one like where you have a large set of connected nodes. Like the neurons in a brain, only we're thinking of people connected to each other in a society. As an aside, the mathematics of that, the functional description of those two things are basically the same. End of aside. Teachers are nodes, students are nodes. To learn is to be the node. And both teaching and learning consist of sending and receiving communications to these other nodes. Sending, remixing, repurposing. And so learning, properly so-called, happens fundamentally and importantly in two ways. First of all, society as a whole learns. And what that means is society as a whole creates a network of connections between its component members, component individuals, where each individual is a node in society as a whole. Each individual transmits and receives signals, content of some sort, to each other. And secondly, individuals learn by growing this network of connections between their own neurons. And these two things work back and forth, right? Social learning informs personal learning. Personal learning informs social learning. But the two are separate things. They're not the same thing. Now, in the old days, prehistory, 10 years ago, communications between these nodes were typically text-based. They were composed of language, of books, paragraphs, sentences. And fundamentally and crucially, the materials used for such communications were free. Free in every sense of the word. The letters. Nobody owns the letter A, not even Sesame Street. The word, it's, think about it, right? Sesame Street, talking about programming a culture. This program was sponsored by the letter A. You've associated ownership and letters. How subversive is that? Anyhow. Letters are free. Words are free. You coin a word, you can't own it, really, except under very limited circumstances. The grammar is free. Nobody owns the equi, whatever, whatever. The syntax of a language is free. And that's what makes communication possible. Anybody can use any word in any of the approved combinations to express any message. That's freedom. Nobody owns language, although today there are, of course, many pressures to change that, which is why you see TM scattered through marketing copy. Today, our communications are no longer simply text-based. They are in the form of what might be called multimedia objects, what might be called learning objects, what might be called learning resources. More generally, we as a society send cultural artifacts back and forth to each other as though they were words. The recording of this talk I'm going to send out to people as though it was like a single word or a single sentence. Lolcats, I'm sure you... If you're not familiar with lolcats, look it up. It's a scream. It begins with the cat. I can has cheeseburger. And when some person sends a lolcat to another person, they are sending a message, a very simple message, an absolutely culturally bound message, one that sender and receiver understand in particular ways. But they are using that lolcat as though it were a word in some sort of weird, more advanced language. YouTube videos, same kind of thing. You know, the Mentos Coke video, think about all the messages there. Or even more significantly. The Obama, yes, we can video, or the John McCain, no, you can't video. All of these things are messages. These cultural artifacts, like language, as the new language of thought, need to be free. Otherwise, we can't communicate. Otherwise, only privileged voices get to communicate. The free movement of cultural artifacts fosters learning, fosters what we become. The hindered movement fosters control. Yeah, Al Gore described this in detail in The Assault on Reason. Gore talks about a society that used to think for itself through reading and then had its thinking done for it through television. And, well, we've seen the results of that. And we would like to move into a society that thinks for itself again, but not by going back to reading, because reading is very narrow and very confining, but thinking for itself through the use of multimedia. Now, I'm running low on time here, so I'm going to go a bit faster than I would like, but I want to touch on this, so I'm going to ask your indulgence for a little bit of time. I have a history of supporting non-commercial, and that was the point of my exchange with Richard Solomon the other day. And my reason for this is that the commercial use of learning resources constitutes a form of restriction and not a form of freedom. The commercial use of learning resources is what puts that barrier screen on me when I'm trying to find out what that plant is. And my perspective on licensing has to do from the point of view of the learner, the point of view of somebody who's trying to find out what kind of silly plant this is. Commercial uses of content form barriers to learning. They starve the learner of the diverse perspectives they need to learn. They take that network and they prune that network. They get rid of all the non-official forms of learning so that the only learning you have is the official form of learning. They want to replace thinking for yourself with them thinking for you. Now, let me be clear. By commercial use, I do not mean use by a commercial entity. I think that is a huge red herring that has been thrown out there. It would be a ridiculous definition of commercial to say that, you know, use by any commercial entity is commercial use. If Microsoft uses Linux in its office somewhere, that's commercial use. That's ridiculous. What I mean very specifically by commercial use is use that is commercial. That is use, that is the exchange of access to the resource in return for money. In particular, unless you give them money, you do not get access to the resource. And it is therefore, by definition, a limitation of access. Commercial use, to me, by definition, violates any free license. Exchanging access to the resource in return for money means the only way of accessing the resource to pay money is to pay money. And that's the big difference between free software and free content. Free software, when somebody sells software, even free software, usually you can get it some other way. The purchasers have computers. They're not impoverished. They're not dirt poor. Because they have computers, they have a way of exchanging content with each other in the form of floppy disks or internet connections. And software itself exists only in one medium, in the digital medium. So you can't put software into a medium that's incompatible with computers. But in the world of content, and especially educational content, there are very entrenched what might be called content enclaves. Go to your bookstore, for example. Count the number of free books available in the bookstore. There are, none. Learners in an educational environment based on the class, remember, are very often placed in a position of being required to use commercial content. And a good example of that is that website that we just saw at the beginning of this presentation. And this is nothing new. This is what entrenched, established markets do. This is what will may happen to software over time, Reed Shapiro of Variant Information Rules, you see this all mapped out. All the different ways of creating types of barriers to content. Lockout, preventing access to content through subscriptions and other sorts of user registrations. Lock-in, proprietary content, closed markets, enterprise solutions. Making it impossible for free content to interact or interoperate with other forms of content. Flooding the market with pseudo-free content. This is the Starbucks methodology of coffee marketing. Legal attacks, fair use attacks, patent attacks, the SCO, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, software patents. And as a community overall, we comply with those for the most part. A license like Creative Commons by Share Alike is naive. And I will use that word. It's naive because it provides zero protection against any of those market manipulations. There's nothing contradictory about putting a resource, Creative Commons Share Alike, inside an enterprise computing application that you must pay money to use and then register and log into. A Creative Commons license that allows commercialization allows restricted access because it prevents none of these attacks on free content. The GFDL is better, has other problems, but it is too also naive when it comes to these manipulations. In my view, a license that includes clauses sufficient to bar or to prevent all of these market manipulations is functionally equivalent to non-commercial. Now, I don't mind saying, yes, we allow commercial access so long as you do not prevent access to anyone. I don't mind saying a private school can offer access to free learning materials so long as that private school does not prevent access by anyone to those materials. That would mean that if a private school uses a learning material, they need, and it's a free learning material, they need to make access to that material open to everybody both inside and outside the school. In this context, what is public education? It is the idea that learning is constituted of a language of education, that is in turn constituted of public goods, things that are owned by all of us, and to which access is prevented to none of us. And that the role of public entities, government, universities, schools, is to protect and to support and to foster the creation of and diversity of entities in that language. And that, sorry about the device, that is my proposition I put for you today. Thank you very much.
Large parts of it I do agree with. I have some questions about the last part about non-commercial. In the free software communities, we use free licenses. Give you the freedom to ask money so that people can sustain themselves. It enables a sustainable community. Now, I wonder how you foresee that in a worldwide community where we create educational materials, learning resources, as you suggest. How can we make that ecosystem sustainable then? If people cannot sell their services, I have to ask permission to the Open University of the UK if I want to print one of their books. So I'm not going to, and I cannot use those materials if I have a training company.
Okay. First of all, the purpose of having, or the purpose of allowing commercial distribution in the free software licenses is not in order that the community can sustain itself, right? It is because commercial has been defined as part of free, right? And it's a definition of free as seen from the perspective of the person who has the software. And so the person can distribute the software in any way they wish. Richard Stallman and free software advocates in general don't care whether or not the definition sustains an industry. If it happens to, so much the better. But the fundamental value that they are after, as we heard repeatedly 2 days ago, is freedom, not the sustaining of an industry. Okay, so that's the first thing. And so, in part, my response is the same. If your livelihood depends on blocking access to content to poor people, I don't care if you go out of business. Okay? Because what you are doing is fundamentally wrong. So, now you are asking, seeing here I'm nicer than, no, never mind. You are asking, how can I make a living producing combinations of content? And there are many ways to make a living producing combinations of content that do not entail being paid for those combinations of content. For example, when the production of a combination of content constitutes a service. Give you an example of that. Bob Dylan came to play in Moncton the other day, well, a few weeks ago now. What Bob Dylan did is he came, he set himself up in a big hall, charged admission to the hall, got in front of the crowd of people and sang badly a bunch of songs. I'm just kidding. It was great. Right? Bob Dylan performed the service of singing a song. And I, among other people, was willing to pay for that because it's Bob Dylan. Right? Now, Bob Dylan would be worth paying $60 or whatever to see whether or not he charged a dime for his albums. And indeed, other artists don't charge money for their albums, but they still get money for their public performances. So there are all kinds of non-royalty-based ways of making a living. And indeed, most of the world makes their living that way. That's my answer. Sorry, it wasn't short.
No.
For me, it was short.
My question is related to your first part of the presentation, which is on the freedom concept. So you tend to think that the fifth freedom that you're talking about, freedom as access, as vis-a-vis, or as a kind of state of being, and not as a doing. So you made a distinction between doing and being.
Right.
Stated that the church's definition is more about doing. And I would, I'm wondering how could any being can exist in a state of being in freedom without acting, because being is an agent. And from that point of view, I see that these four freedoms that the church is actually defining are four actions, which enable you to remain in the state of in freedom. So in that sense, that looks like a precondition for being in a state of freedom. And therefore, I do not see how your freedom of being in access actually becomes even more general. Because it appears to me that the church's freedoms are the causes for the state of being in freedom. And therefore, it doesn't appear that you actually need something of that kind, because it's really vacuous to me to think of such a generic definition from which you can't even define this four fields. And that seems to be a conceptual misunderstanding, or maybe a disagreement. I just don't know what it is.
I view Richard's freedoms as lesser included freedoms. By that, what I mean is those freedoms are necessary but not sufficient to be free. they're necessary in the sense that you can't be free without them. But even with them, there are many, many contexts, and education is one of them. The whole discussion of education is one of them. Even with them, you might not be free for other reasons. Richard's conditions are not enough. It's like saying you can be free in a country if you have freedom of speech and freedom of the press. And that I look at that and say, well, tell that to the people in Darfur. They can print whatever they want. You know? So you need more than just the capacity to do. You need the capacity to be free. And being free means not just having certain scope of action, but it also means having a certain guaranteed access to the public good, where in this particular case, and my argument would be defined more generally in other circumstances, but in this particular case, access to the public good, which constitutes the language that we use to communicate. If you don't have access to that language, you are not free. And that access to that language is the thing that is not guaranteed by Richard's Four Freedoms. Well, I understand the meanings of it. I just don't agree that it's sufficient to create freedom. And I've sketched a number of cases where it doesn't create freedom. So don't say, I don't understand the meaning. I understand the meaning perfectly well. I just disagree with you.
Because the solution clearly makes a very clear case of what you mean by having freedom to use. And there he mentions a lot of things. You cannot, for example, use unless you have an access, first of all, and unless you have an ability to interpret and decode it. And therefore, you know, these are all the preconditions that are elaborated in the first freedom.
I understand
and
that.
Therefore, the access is part of the very first freedom. If you don't have access, freedom, you can't even use it. So that's the reason why I'm failing to understand, because from a conceptual point of view, I fail to understand how your freedom can actually...
If you are selling me something and in some way legally or in some other way preventing access, you are blocking my freedom.
Therefore, the freedom of zero is not there.
I'm sorry?
Therefore, the first criterion to be free is not available.
But free software allows for selling software. It allows for the creation of markets in which the only way to access software is to pay for it. It allows for that.
That's because agents spend time to provide access.
No, that's not why it's there. That's not the purpose of it there. It's there because he thinks that's what freedom is.
I'm sorry, but we have run out of time completely. Please join me thanking the speaker. I have a very brief announcement. We are going to stay in this room at 5 for